Hello and welcome to The Right Idea, where we discuss the people, policy, and politics that drive Texas. I'm your host, Brian Phillips. I'm the Chief Communications Officer at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And with me, as always, is my co-host, our Vice President of Research, Derek Cohen. Derek, the hot topic, hot take of the day, we got to talk about it. Kate Middleton photo, controversy. Why does it matter to the American people? And what's your hot take?
Well, everyone knows. I mean, this has been a pattern of the royal family for some time. Kate Middleton, of course, is a well-known psyop, right? I think we can all agree. And I think it was announced earlier this year that Sir Lewis Hamilton will be joining Ferrari in the F1.
I mean, you are making
context.
All kinds of connections.
Oh, did you see all the red string I got on my board? You know, going, this is Pepe Silvio level stuff. And, you know, so there's probably going to be some sort of transition from, you know, the, you know, English aristocracy over to the Italian one. So that's what I think it's all laying the groundwork for. But, you know, this is all backed by Pfizer. So, you know, you can read more about that on my blog.
Excellent. All right. We'll look forward to that. Actually, if she was a psyop, that actually would make me more interested, or any level of interest in the royals as well.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think that we have had, a couple hundred years of where we stand on the royals being pretty well established.
All right. So shameless plug of the day. I'll get that over with now because we have a couple of big announcements. One, obviously, The Post is our newsletter that I do exclusive content for. We always have something fun, something Texas-y, and then there's always kind of a compilation of what TPPF is working on. In that newsletter, go to texaspolicy.com/thepost to sign up for that. It's a fantastic product. Also, I want to pitch our big annual conference, what I believe is the largest gathering of policy nerds, conservative policy nerds around the country to talk about policy. We talk about Texas policy, but also national policy. It's called the Texas Policy Summit. It's happening next week. I believe there's still tickets available. You can go to texaspolicysummit.com to look at that. But if you can't make it to Austin or can't make it to the conference, everything is live streamed. So you can look at every single panel we have, every single keynote. I believe the Lieutenant Governor's coming, and as well as other special guests. And then if you do miss that, if you can't watch it live, we do archive everything. And of course, if you're following our social media, we'll have clips everywhere. So you can't miss it if you're following Texas Public Policy Foundation. Okay, getting to the fun part of the day. We are super excited. I've wanted to have someone come on from the University of Austin for a long time. Very excited to have Jacob Howland, who is the provost at the University of Austin, UATX, as they like to call it here. ATX is what I like to call Austin, is also the Dean of Intellectual Foundations. Previously, Howland served as the McFarland Professor of Philosophy at the University of Tulsa and a senior fellow at the Tikva Fund. Did
Correct.
I say that right?
Yep.
Fantastic. He's the author of 5 books and is a prolific writer and all of those wonderful things. And there's lots of different angles to Jacob that I want to talk about, both his experience, but also just in general, the University of Austin. So yeah, definitely.
a common mistake.
I'm a proud Longhorn and we're in Austin, so I will probably make that mistake 100 times.
We're frenemies.
Excellent. Excellent. And we'll talk about some of their recent decisions. So Jacob, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Brian.
Well, this is awesome. So, I mean, I will just be very unapologetic about my interest in having you here. We were, TPPF was very interested and watched very closely the creation of the University of Austin. Some of the reasons why we'll expound on here that you all started the university were some of, you know, we were cheering from the sidelines, hoping that you all would do good. And here you are, I guess, a year or two, maybe. I mean, you tell me how long you guys have been at it, but it feels like we're over the hump, successful. Tell me all the things, and we'd love for you to take a big victory lap here.
Yeah, so we were our formation was publicly announced in November 2021, and we decided that we would open our doors to our first cohort of undergraduate students in the fall of 2024. And in fact, we are opening on September 9th coming up. So we have founded this university. We've built it inside of 3 years, and we've done it with a very lean team. I mean, we didn't hit 24 employees until the end of 2023. Mm-hmm. We now have about 30. I think we started out with 3 or 4, literally. I came on, I think, at the very end of April in 2022. And we've been, it's been like being strapped to a solid fuel rocket. I mean, this has always been kind of a moonshot, right? We had to, like, if we're going to make our target, which was to open in the fall of 2024, we had to very quickly raise lots of money, generate significant intellectual and operational energy. Mm-hmm. And we've been going on a constant high burn, you know, and mm-hmm. and sort of encountering atmospheric anomalies and buffeting winds as we move along, regulatory capture, things like that.
And not just the natural elements in the world that are difficult to overcome, but you have people shooting at you. You have left-wing whack job aliens out there in the world shooting at your rocket, trying to knock it off course and destroy it.
Yeah, it's really strange. You know, I know the number of colleges and universities in the United States is slowly diminishing. Because, you know, little liberal arts colleges are going out of business and so forth. But I think they're still around 4,000. Mm-hmm. And it's very strange that one new university would attract so much heat, right? But, you know, we're excited about some of the other educational alternatives. There's a place mm-hmm. called Hildegard College that just opened. Of course, you've got Ralston. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk has announced that he wants to start a university. Frankly, I'm really excited for him to do that. Because once he realizes the sort of bureaucratic difficulties mm-hmm. that are involved in getting a new institution off the ground, then he'll use his big bullhorn to tell the world about it.
I mean, what's harder, that or trying to put somebody on Mars? He's trying to figure that out right now. Derek, what do you make?
I'm going to go with the Mars thing, actually, but nonetheless, it's not easy.
Six of one, half dozen the other.
Yeah, exactly. Derek, what do you make of that? I mean, maybe that's the reason why the left wing was so anti the creation of this, is because if you were successful, and now that you have been successful, that it would encourage others to do the same thing and break that sort of mold that the universities have.
Well, just relying on my own experience in academia, I can say that I don't disagree with a single observation made. If I had to attribute it to a particular cause, it's, you know, they've had their long march through the institution and they're tired of walking, and now there's another couple miles added on to the end. That being said, it's I think UATX is starting to scratch an itch that people are starting to see with this general disenfranchisement with higher education more generally, right? You know, we see folks coming out of high school and, you know, with this college for all, college for everyone, it is basically becoming not a niche part of your life where you're going to explore something very personal to you. It turns out to be it's either remediation of the previous 12 years or it's as cookie cutter of a broad swath curriculum as you can apply.
Yeah.
And then maybe you'd graduate with a degree in communications or, you know, maybe even a legitimate career field. Mm-hmm. But that's just going for, didn't even get a reaction out of him. The comms guy. No, but all that to say is they turn out to be trade schools where you don't actually learn a trade.
That's right. And I want to use this quote. This is getting ahead, but actually this is a great time to jump in this quote. You wrote in a piece on Unheard, the ideological invasion of the ivory tower has had predictably bad results. Much of higher education today effectively consists of giving students a handful of post-it notes and teaching them how to apply them to images that are projected on their smartphones. That's very vivid. How does your curriculum break through that, or how does your curriculum differ than from other institutions?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say that, you know, the job of universities has always been the preservation, extension, and transmission of knowledge. Today, with the ideological capture, especially of elite institutions, who pretty much set the standard, you know, for other institutions. It's not so much the preservation of knowledge, but the destruction or at least the suppression of the precious legacy of the past. I mean, our ancestors struggled and suffered, learned through their experiences, gave us records of what they've learned, transmitted amazing legacies of music and art and political wisdom and so forth. In the last few decades, that has... ever since I would say, you know, Jesse Jackson marched at Stanford and led the chant of "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go," the commitment of universities to study the Western tradition has been diminishing. So first of all, those kinds of books and texts and speeches and all that are often not studied at all. And to the extent that they are, and that students are required to learn about them, there's this ideological approach, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, I had a student who was at the University of Chicago, and she was a Russian studies major, and she said when she was studying Dostoevsky, they would warn them, first of all, okay, the guy is kind of, you know, a religious nut, and he's, you know, and they would tell them everything that they needed to know about what's bad about Dostoevsky before they even encountered the ideas. So And then in terms of the transmission and extension, what's being transmitted is very often ideology. So the core of education has been hollowed out. And I mean, in general, universities are offering a kind of inferior product at increasingly unaffordable prices. One measure, for example, is that students are not job ready. Employers complain regularly. They don't know how to analyze things. They don't know how to engage in teamwork. Their communication skills are poor, et cetera. Okay, so what are we doing about those things? We have three sort of elements in our curriculum. One is the Intellectual Foundations Program that freshmen and sophomores take. This is a way of establishing an intellectual culture at the school. All the students read the same books and take the same classes at the same time.
And this is what you're dean of.
I am the dean
of
that.
So all the freshmen and sophomores have to go through you to make it to the end.
Right. So, and these courses, there's a kind of historical arc. So we start at the beginning. Courses with titles like Chaos and Civilization. What is civilization? Why do we need it? Where did it come from? Beginning of politics, right? Are we political animals? Mm-hmm. What's law for, right? And then we have courses, for example, on modernity in the West, Christianity and Islam, Europe and the East. We have courses on the uses and abuses of technology, courses on ideological experiments of the 20th century. The contrast to that would be our course on the American experiment. So these are all oriented by fundamental questions. Okay, so they get that core of the legacy of the past and the best ideas, but also many of the best ideas of today. So we have very varied readings. The second element is our centers of academic inquiry. So once students get through Intellectual Foundations, they can then join either the STEM Center or the Center for Economics, Politics, and History, or the Center for Arts and Letters. And each of those centers have interdisciplinary cores. So for example, in Economics, Politics, and History, they're going to get an integrated social science core, which requires studying historical methodology, political science techniques, history, etc. And then the third component of our education, which is most exciting, is what we call our Polaris Project. It's named after the North Star, something to aim at. You're never going to reach it, but it's a sort of navigational guide for your education. And the idea there is for students to come up with a project that serves a human need or serves the human good. This is connected with Intellectual Foundations, because in order to come up with a viable project, you have to understand what a human being is. You have to have sort of absorbed the lessons about human flourishing and, let's say, human anthropology that are contained in Intellectual Foundations. And we're going to have our students, by the way, write iterations of an essay that connects that learning with their particular analysis of what would make people's lives better here in 2024. What do people need? And their projects could be public service, they could be technology, they could be starting some kind of business. But they aim high.
And they have to finish these projects by the end of their sophomore year?
No, they have to finish the projects by the end of their senior
year. Okay, all right.
And we actually have courses in the Polaris program, like Polaris Ideas. In the very first term, they're going to learn, where do ideas come from? How do you get them?
Yeah.
Right? What is entrepreneurship, in sort of civic entrepreneurship? What is innovation? What are the social conditions under which innovation can occur? Which, incidentally, this is one of the reasons we love to be in Austin, because this is startup central. There's so much intellectual energy here. And let's say also kind of alternative intellectual energy, not, you know, the kind of energy that's generated by the credential mills of the Ivy League.
Right. And so, you know, to that end, then, well, I've got two questions. One, I want to talk about the student body. Like, what kind of students are you looking for? You know, because, I mean, this is very different than what I think a lot of students are, you know, oh, I'm going to go to college because I'm going to learn things that are going to, you know, teach me a trade or teach me to, you know, make money. This is like learning how to think, which, you know, the schools aren't doing a very good job of at least preparing people to learn how to think between, you know, by the time they graduate high school. How do you encourage the right students? Is that the way to say it? Or just what kind of students are you looking for to apply?
So we're looking for students with three qualities, grace, grit, and gratitude. Why grace? Well, first of all, universities are, I would say, ungracious places in terms of discourse and conversation. If you look at the polls, a large majority of faculty and students at institutions across the country say they are afraid to express their honest opinions about controversial subjects. So students and teachers live in an atmosphere of fear. By the way, this is very bad for education, because if I'm worried that, you know, you're going to capture me on your smartphone saying something that you object to, and then you're going to post it on Instagram or something like that, I am going to be afraid to make mistakes. How do you learn? I would ask you, could you learn to ride a bicycle if I told you, here's the deal, Brian, you can't fall off. Okay, you must never fall off the bike. Mm-hmm. You can't. So, and in addition, the atmosphere of universities is teaching people to live by lies. I mean, literally to dissimulate, right? Mm. To agree with things that they don't agree with. I mean, at least in public.
Mm. Or just to blanketly adopt certain ideologies,
right?
Because they won't be challenged. Like that's the easy way that they corral people into these right. ideologies is they say, well, if you adopt these ideologies, we won't challenge you and we won't, you know, we won't poke at you or whatever. And so you say, well, okay, then I guess I'll adopt that one because that's the easiest direction for me to go.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I agree with Aristotle's first line of his Metaphysics. He says all human beings desire by nature to know. Maybe some only a little bit, but the point is the desire for truth is only one human desire. The desire to fit into your social surroundings is another desire. And in our social conditions today, and especially at universities, people have to make a choice. You know, do I want to speak up and say something like, well, I understand that masks aren't that effective, or I understand that, you know, this COVID might have come from a laboratory or something like that. Now, you uttered those things in 2020, and you're likely to be called out.
Yeah. You got canceled, and you got deplatformed right. and everything else.
So what do I mean by grace? Well, grace means the ability to engage with others whose opinions you don't agree with in a gracious way, right? To listen, to engage in open inquiry and civil discourse, all in the cause of the pursuit of truth. Grit means the characteristic of not being afraid to fail. And then try again, and then fail better, right? And that's what's going to be involved in our Polaris program. So incidentally, when we engage in reviewing students who have applied to the University of Austin, we look at academic potential and achievement. We also look at leadership and creativity. So we are filtering for students who have displayed at least some indication of thinking creatively and of wanting to be engaged in leadership roles. So these are people who have a certain kind of boldness, okay? So that's all folded into the grit. And the gratitude is, look, we live in the best nation in the world still. Students are very, very fortunate to be able to attend college. We want students who are going to embrace the opportunities that they have, not just for having a good time, which is certainly part of college, but to learn, right? Mm-hmm. So we have this application process. Of course, we require standardized tests. And I like to think, although it's not provable, that with Brown and, you know, Yale and now the University of Texas and other schools bringing back the SATs, mm-hmm. that we've had some effect on that. Yep. But in any case, so that's the sort of profile that we're looking at. And I can say a little bit about the kinds of students who have applied as well, if you like. But that's the overview.
Derek, jump in here.
Yeah.
Well, no, I wanted to ask specifically, well, we're kind of talking about like typologies, and that's really great to hear about the kind of the framework of the typical student or at least the ideal student that y'all are bringing in. I have a similar question about the faculty. Mm-hmm. So if you look at how higher education has become kind of a left-wing monolith, it essentially came from the faculty. First, they organize, around labor principles, you mm-hmm. know, through the AAUP, whatever the course might be. But then once they have that ascendant power within the actual framework of the university, that's where the debate shuts down. That's where there becomes a unitary voice wherein dissenters are smacked down and mm-hmm. brushed away. What sort of things will the University of Austin be doing to kind of guard against that? Because, you know, any sort of, I would say, ideological hegemony, left, right, or center,
right.
seems fairly anathema to your project.
Can I use a quote real quick to bounce off of that? Because I want to get to the faculty, too, so I want to use this quote now. You wrote, you're talking about the issue of the college presidents and them resigning and the controversy that happened at their testimonies and all that. You wrote, the deeper problem is that the intellectual formation of large numbers of faculty and administrators at American universities supports acts of violence so appalling that that to call them barbaric would be an insult to barbarians. That's
yeah, so I was talking about Hamas there. Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, but you know, that's a you're painting that picture.
Yeah.
Of the faculty. How do you address that?
Yeah. So let me first say that the faculty certainly are a problem, but another problem is the administration. So if you go back 50 years and you look at a university like, let's say, Cornell, the deans and the presidents would have been accomplished researchers. Like they would have paid their dues in academia. Okay. In the last few decades, we've seen administrators who really are not academics. That's not why they're there. And I would point to Claudine Gay. In particular, I mean, it's astonishing, you know, that she's written, I don't know, something like 10 articles, 11 articles, plagiarized all over the place, of course. She wasn't hired as president of the premier university in the United States because of her academic chops, okay? And universities have been taken over by administrators who are very interested in things like DEI. Which, frankly, I think is completely anathema to education.
Absolutely.
Because
Amen.
It's requiring people to, you know, in many, many cases, to either be employed or to be promoted to sign these DEI oaths, okay? So that's a big problem, and the tone is kind of set by the top. Okay, so how are we going to avoid institutional takeover? Good question. first of all, we are growing slowly. I gave a speech at Dartmouth, and I was actually misquoted in the Dartmouth student newspaper.
Sure.
I said that if we were going to start with, let's say, 2,000 students, we would already have lost right out of the gate because we would have had to hire a whole bunch of faculty, and we could not adequately vet them. So what kind of faculty are we looking for? We are looking for faculty who understand that the job is teaching. That's the job. In universities, we're looking for outstanding teachers. And let me comment parenthetically here. The university world is sort of upside down because if you climb to the highest rung at the most elite institution as a faculty member, do you know what your reward is? You don't teach. That's the reward, right? You're right. A research professor of X, right? Maybe you teach a class a year or something, but you know. So, but this is inverted. So number one, students who, faculty who value teaching and are, in fact, outstanding teachers. Mm-hmm. Second, we're looking for faculty who are outstanding students, minds that delight in learning, okay, and who don't approach any academic or intellectual subject with hostility. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know that there are people who are like experts in a little narrow area, but, you know, but we're humanities. I don't know anything about science. I don't care about it. We really want to build an intellectual community of not just faculty and students, but faculty connecting with faculty. And our vision is kind of is integrating all the disciplines so that students will form an understanding of the whole and ultimately form good judgment. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we're looking for is serious pedagogical and mentoring energy. Our inaugural faculty, our founding faculty, are going to have to roll up their sleeves and help to build the institution. And finally, mission fit. And that means that when we hire faculty, they understand no small p politics in the classroom. I tell every group of faculty coming in, and I can talk about our kind of innovative interviewing system if you like, that politics does not belong in the classroom. Now, let me be clear about what this means. If you're reading, let's say, Aristotle's Ethics, or whatever the great text is, students are going to understand that the ideas there connect with what's happening today in the world. I encourage that 100%. It's a nice way to talk about issues. So you're reading Plato's Republic and the question of the difference between males and females comes up, okay? Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful entryway, a kind of indirect entry into the kinds of issues we're seeing today, mm-hmm. where sexuality is up for grabs, it's not clear who's a male, female, etc., right? So we create a space for these kinds of conversations. Faculty understand that that's what they're supposed to be doing, not saying, mm-hmm. by the way, you know, Biden is an idiot or Trump is a fool or whatever it may be.
Right.
And frankly, that kind of inappropriate speech in the classroom is really par for the course in a lot of institutions. I know it was at the University of Tulsa.
Yeah, so I'll dig in and say, yeah, that's you know, in the interest of transparency, I mean, how do you vet your faculty? Because I think that's one of the things that we're finding in other universities, that once we started digging into it and you see these like diversity statements and all that kind of stuff, that's where the real rubber meets the road in terms of like turning the staff into this ideological mob that then infects the kids. One of the lazy critiques, I'll say, but if I'll just use one of them, is that of your organization, is that you know, you complain about the ideology of the left wing universities. You're just imposing your own ideology.
Right,
you're imposing your own philosophy,
right.
And that through these new vetting techniques, which I want you to get into, you're just doing the same thing as they are, but from a right wing perspective.
Right. Okay. So one point is that we are the only university in the country with a constitution. Everything we do is governed by the Constitution, from admission to curriculum to, you know, faculty, student relations, and so forth. And in the Constitution, it is specified that faculty are to be exemplars, models of our, what you might call values, right? Our priorities. So first of all, if we had faculty who were in the classroom and politicking in the way that many faculty do, they would be in violation of the Constitution. By the way, since I'm talking about the Constitution, we're also the only institution in the country that has something like a Supreme Court. This was modeled on the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution was largely drafted by Neil Ferguson, the great historian. And so we have this thing called an adjudicative panel that can entertain challenges by anybody in the university that someone or some group of people have violated the Constitution. This adjudicative panel will be composed of constitutional scholars, academics, other high-profile people with no conflicts of interest, and they will decide whether this case is merited and then propose an appropriate solution or punishment or whatever it may be. And we are bound by our Constitution to adhere to what they say, okay? So the Constitution already has these pieces in place saying, doesn't matter if you're left or right, we're just not going to allow these kinds of behaviors in the classroom. Now, let me talk to you about the selection process. When you're moving at a blistering pace, you have to be inventive. I mean, because certain problems come up that wouldn't otherwise occur. We didn't get authorized by the state of Texas to call ourselves a university and open our doors until November of last year. We needed to hire by April 1st, roughly, roughly 18 new faculty. We had 900 applications. So we went through all these applications. We got down to 36 finalists. Now, it is logistically impossible in the time frame to bring in, as universities usually do, individual candidates to campus for interviews. So we decided, let's have a series of weeks. Every single week, we'll bring in 6 candidates at a time. Okay, but then what are we going to do with them?
Barry Weiss, she can interview them on her podcast.
Right. So how are we going to filter? Like, how are we going to structure this thing? And then we hit upon a really innovative idea, which I think is very exciting. It could be used with great profit by other universities. We decided, you got 6 candidates. We're going to have 2 blocks of 2 hours on one day. In the first block of 2 hours, candidates A, B, and C will give 20-minute presentations on their work, their methodology or their approach, and illustrate it with an example, and what their 5-year research plans are. Then questions will be asked. The first questions will be asked by the other 3 candidates who are speaking in the afternoon. And then in the afternoon, they switch around, and it's vice versa. What does this do? It allows us to see whether people are collegial, whether they're open-minded, whether they're actually interested, if you're a humanities professor, in what this computer science guy is saying, right? And it allows candidates also to see the quality and the kinds of people who would be their colleagues if they came to the University of Austin. It has been overwhelmingly popular with the candidates. They have felt more relaxed. Everyone's in the same boat. They have described these days as mini seminars where they learn about all kinds of different approaches. Incidentally, we don't put people head to head. We don't bring like in 2 Americanists who are now going to speak on the same day, right? Mm-hmm. That would be cruel. but this has actually proved very useful. Now we've done our homework and we proceeded very well, but there are a couple of candidates that we saw who, for example, went on and on in their presentation, you know, or told other candidates, hey, you know, Brian, you should have said this rather than that in your presentation.
Wow.
And these are indications that, you know, you might not.
Not a cultural fit there.
Not a fit, right.
Now, Derek, I see you salivating over there. Are you thinking about a return to academia?
Well,
now?
No. I was about to say the big thing was.
Send us your CV.
No. We just promoted him. We just promoted him.
No, it gave me a little bit of flashbacks, given job talks during the ABD process. And essentially, much like you said, you know, those were more exhortations of fealty to whatever the ascendant ideology was.
Right.
And, you know, I just remember in my own experience, I went to a couple of universities that were fairly ideologically centrist or non-involved, which makes them absolutely to the right in the grand scheme of academia.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it wasn't necessarily what is it that you're presenting? What is it that you're, you know, I mean, again, it was the same. It was very similar in terms of presenting a, you know, your research plan, your research trajectory, as well as a particular project that you had done. But again, it was more there, and rather than engaging with the how is it you do it, it is what, you know, are mm-hmm. you saying the right things? Are
yes.
you checking the boxes? You know, are you going to are you going to rock the boat, essentially?
Mm.
And so the very nature of academic inquiry, that which you're seeking to foster, is almost, you know, that mole is whacked on the head, you know, right from the hiring standpoint. Mm. And just to hear a institution that is not only cognizant of it, but actively working against that, you know, that bug in the system mm-hmm. is just great to hear.
I also like the philosophy, which we share here at TPPF, which is that the reward for good work is more work. And so the higher up that you go there at UATX, yeah. the more work you're going to do.
Yeah. You know, let me say something to Derek's point about the way things usually work. So our institution also does not have tenure. Now, you know, we've gotten a lot of questions about this. So why don't we have tenure? Well, tenure means the following. You need your departmental support to get tenure. So let's say you're hired at a certain department. It is the case that in the humanities and social sciences, the ratio of folks on the left compared to the right is 12 to 1 or higher. And it's already now affecting the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that. But mm-hmm. in any case, therefore, if you're going to come up for tenure, you better please your colleagues. And that means that there is a question of fitting into, and at least pretending, if you like, right, that, you know, you're aligned with their ideological priorities and so forth. And that means that tenure has become a way of excluding alternative views.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our adjudicative panel, our Supreme Court, protects freedom of speech right from the beginning. Because, you know, you could be hired and in your first week you bring a charge. Hey, things aren't working out the way they are. And you're going to be protected if the charge has merit. So that's why we don't have tenure. And I think that's really, really important mm-hmm. To note.
I wonder if the leftists are already thinking about ways to pack your court so they can get more votes on there. You mentioned the hard sciences. There was an article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal from John Saylor about NIH and mm-hmm. how they are, you talk about the hard sciences, how they are pushing DEI into the universities with their various grants. So even when you have a state like Texas, which is trying to outlaw DEI at the university level, you still have these sort of sneaky backdoor ways, which brings yes. me to another discussion about we have to have the conversation about funding, about public funding, private funding. Where are you guys at on all that? Subsidies, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So first of all, we don't and can't or couldn't take any money from the federal government until we are nationally accredited.
Mm-hmm.
So I said earlier, the state of Texas authorized us to be a university. But the state of Texas also requires that within a certain amount of time, we become accredited by one of the formerly regional and now national accreditation agencies. And there are six of those right now. The Department of Education is generally quite leery of letting new entrants into this field. The accreditation agencies, unfortunately, are also pushing DEI. Mm-hmm. All of them are. And it's really quite amazing. You can go on their websites and read, and they have statements about, like, infusing every dimension of the university with DEI.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we can't take federal funding until we're accredited. The accreditation process will start essentially in the fall, and it will take at least until we graduate our first cohort, that is 2028, because you can't be accredited before that, which I would like to emphasize because some of our critics say they're not even accredited. Well, no university can be accredited inside of, let's say, 5 years. Okay. So our funding has not been from the federal government. We have raised...
Does that also include, I mean, does that also mean, just for our audiences, so if someone takes out a federal loan, they can't use it at your university?
You can, well, so this is interesting. I'm actually not competent to answer that question. But federal funds, federal loan funds, like Pell Grants or things like this, these are not available to us. And in fact, there's even an issue right now about whether education savings accounts can be used to pay for our university. It's not entirely clear whether that's so at this point. So
don't get us talking about ESAs, because we'll spend the next 2 hours.
Right, right.
That. Okay. Well, I just want to hit that just to make sure, because I'm sure our audience.
Yeah. And I just want to say too, though, we have an outstanding advancement team. Our goal was to raise $250 million in the first 3 years. We're going to hit that at least 6 months early, you know, by June, let's say, something
amazing.
Like that.
Awesome. That is amazing.
And I should also mention, by the way, that I won't name names, but if I named, I could name at least three names of big donors to Harvard and Penn and other Ivy Leagues who have contacted us, spoken with us, and in one case already given us money and intend to give more.
Name the names. Come on, break some news here. I'm dying. I will say, it is interesting. You do have a brick and mortar school. It's not a lot of people think maybe this is just virtual or online or Zoom or whatever, but you do have an actual building literally three blocks away from us. I will say, and I don't know if you're familiar with the layout of downtown, but you are on the historic, very famous 6th Street down here in Austin, and you are right at the line at 6th and Congress, which is known as what is once side is West 6th, the other side is East 6th. One, I would say, is sort of where your responsible college kids go to party. The other one is called Dirty 6th,
yes.
Which I would try and stay away from that.
Yes.
If I were you, are you planning on, what's the plan going into this fall of keeping your kids on the right side of college?
Right. So our students will have brand new housing. We actually just toured the building, which is still under construction, last week. It'll be finished within, I think the construction will be done in 7 weeks, so we're not worried about them being open at the time. In a brand new building very near or in the neighborhood of Texas's student housing, okay? Mm-hmm. So and with a view of the tower, and they're right there. We're going to have shuttles that bring them back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good question. Of course, some students will wander onto the Dirty 6th Street. But we hope to keep them pretty busy with their academics.
That's good.
That's good.
Derek, look, I know it's been a long time since you've been in that area.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm waiting for your actual academic paper. What does Starbar say about the decline of Western civilization?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes, which wouldn't be hard to write, unfortunately. Well, Austin, of course, we're in the middle of South by Southwest. It's just started here, which is what we consider to be the unofficial beginning of festival season. And now we have some kind of festival or something going on every weekend right in your neighborhood, basically in downtown, between now and the time we get to ACL. Are you planning on partaking in any of the South By? Because there's a lot of cultural, educational
music. Well,
we did
actually partake in South By. In fact, last week we opened, we had a wonderful event on our campus, which is the third floor of the Scarborough building.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to expand to other floors for sure, which are, there are some that are empty. But we have a really beautiful space with a beautiful atrium and skylight.
Awesome.
And we had the launch of what we're calling the Austin Union, which is going to be our student debating society, modeled after the Oxford Union. So we had a debate between Morgan Marietta and I think his name is Robert Albert, if I'm not mistaken. He's a professor at the University of Texas, a constitutional scholar. The debate was, what is the Constitution broken? And then we had, immediately following that, the same evening, a discussion between Nadine Strossen, the former head of the ACLU, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., which was wonderful. So that was a big feature of South by Southwest. We also went down to South by Southwest EDU and invited people to come meet the deans and so forth. And, we got a lot of interest. So we will continue to participate, no doubt, in South by Southwest.
The average campus, a feature of any kind of political debate is a massive protest on one side or the other. How are you planning on handling all the protests?
Well, it depends. I mean, people can protest against us. Obviously, we wouldn't welcome hostile protesters into our campus. But if you want to talk about student protests, that is to say, if our students decide, hey, we're going to, have some kind of protest or something like this, there is latitude for them to do that. This question has come up, though, after October 7th. And, one of the answers is, we are committed to open inquiry and civil discourse, and there are conditions under which that cannot occur. That cannot occur if a group of students feels physically threatened or intimidated by other students. So the kinds of protests that you have at Harvard or Columbia or places, and you know, one of the tests is like, would a Jewish student feel comfortable walking through the crowd of pro-Hamas protesters? In most cases, I would say the answer is no. Those will not be allowed because they violate our fundamental principles. But you know, I mean, if students want to you know, have
hold up signs
a peaceful and demonstration and hold up signs and say, you know, UETX should divest from X, that's fine.
Derek, you know, what do you think there's a response to this, you know, fairly positive so far. Do you think that the left will start to see the universities like this as a threat and start to mobilize maybe through legislative or through litigation or something of that nature to try and discourage the next UETX, although it sounds like it's growing and you're already encouraging other universities to do the same? You know, the left doesn't take this kind of thing standing down. They're, you know, they spent 100 years doing what they did to our public universities. They're not just gonna you know, say, okay, great, we're fine with what's going on over here, right?
I don't believe in the near term, because in the near term you generally see, you know, the critiques basically being more from the, I don't know how else to say this, but the gadfly class of the left-wing commentariat. I think once they meet their goals and they have that class in there and maybe even get that class out, 28, we'll say, then I think that you'll have a demonstrable proof of concept from UATX, and then they're going to have to reckon with that. But also you're going to have, especially if you have some of these elements we've already discussed, like you have basically just great comity on faculty, even across diverse viewpoint holders. You have students who have by this point graduated with a demonstrable interest not only in free inquiry but basically just better rounded for their particular careers. I don't think that there would be at that point much that they can do in the realms of litigation or any other sort of underheadedness, like, and again, the accreditation thing's a whole other thing, but we've talked about accreditation multiple times before. I don't think there's going to be a lot of recourse there. So I think there is going to have to be a bit of a fundamental soul searching, saying maybe even, you know, we don't even need to dispense of our left-wing priors, you know, our, you know, faculty as it is, our administration as it is, being as far to the left as it is. Maybe even we can still take some of these ideas when it comes to hiring and admissions and apply them for ourselves. Now, they're going to think that's in service of their own project. I would disagree. Then they'll find out it actually, oh, wow, this is a great normalizing and balancing force. So and maybe
was going to be my follow-on question is then, you know, obviously not every kid can go to UATX, but then there's a lot of kids that are not at UATX right now. Do you think this will create demand for those kinds of changes? Like, why don't we have a constitution? Why don't we have a constitution like the University of Austin? Why don't we have a Supreme Court or where we feel like we can have our say when we don't feel like we're being treated right, or that the faculty is indoctrinating us? Do you think that kind of spirit will emanate on those campuses, or is it too far gone?
I think that level of change seeking it might be a bit Sisyphean, just because at the very least the similar sub institutions already exist within higher education. You know, I was on the J board at University of Cincinnati, and some of the things that got sent off of that was just heinous. I mean, there were things that would be classified, if it happened one block over from campus, would be classified a felony level crime, but tends to get dismissed because of the J boards are the, you know, that's also the vessel through which all the Title IX shenanigans comes in as well. All that to say is those sub institutions are going to have a hard time divesting themselves of their power. I think you are going to see much more, we'll say rending of garments when that happens. But at the very least, I think that if UATX demonstrates as a viable alternative, you know, both through their growth and through the flattery of imitation, you are going to see more institutions that appeal to this ideal student.
Jacob, when we do a lot of polling and we ask, you know, parents about the higher ed, whether they feel like it's a value and for their, not just a financial value, but also an actual value in terms of what they're learning. And the three things that we always get back are some classification of the cost, the quality of the education, and then, of course, the ideology indoctrination stuff. So one, just college is too expensive. I can't afford it. Then even if I can't afford it, once I go, I'm realizing that the quality of the education is not very good. And then even if I actually like some of my classes and I'm getting a good quality education, I have this stuff over here where it's indoctrinating me into, you know, DEI and all of that. It feels like all the headlines have been around kind of that third part for you guys about pushing back on that kind of thing and having more of a free inquiry and having all ideas. Are you taking into account the first two? And I mean, it sounds a little bit, we talked about the Western Civ and the quality, but that first one of cost, and then am I getting a bang for the buck for my actual quality of education?
Yeah, so we want to bring down the cost of education. And we have various innovations. So for example, we have outsourced a number of administrative functions, for example, pertaining to when students apply and they send in their test scores and so on and so forth. We have a team in Guatemala that actually goes through and collates all this stuff, puts it all together, and gives it to us in an easily readable form, for example. Mm. And so we're looking at sort of offshoring certain functions that can be performed at a lower cost. We're also, I mean, and so far it has been the case, we're very, very lean, and we're trying to prevent administrative bloat. Our tuition for the first year is going to be $32,500. Now, the good news for your listeners is that we're actually going to offer four-year tuition scholarships, complete tuition scholarships for all the first 100 founding students.
Wow.
And this is, you know, obviously a way to try to say, hey, you know, we're new. We want you to buy in. Students are taking a risk. Mm-hmm. Faculty are taking a risk. I mean,
yeah, sure.
You know, it's a startup.
Yeah.
And this is startup city. Everyone who's listening knows, you know, this is always risky. So it is a big principle of ours that, you know, if you look at the average university, something like 30% of the tuition dollars are spent on actual education, educational functions. And mm-hmm. we would like to double that, right? You know, whether we can pull this off remains to be seen, but these are our goals. We really want to keep the cost down. We want the quality to be restored to what it once was in the heyday of higher education in the United mm-hmm. States. And we just don't want the ideological deformation of our courses. Mm-hmm. These are three fundamental things that we are addressing.
Well, this has been a fantastic. I could keep going. I still have a lot of other things I would want to talk to you about, but I want to maybe do a two-part series or have you come back
sure.
once you guys get going, especially in the fall. Mm-hmm. We would love to talk to maybe some students and folks like that as well. We love having you here and giving us the overview. It sounds like you've been on the ground almost since the very beginning, so really giving us the soup to nuts on that. So, you know, first of all, congratulations on this, because there were a lot of haters, a lot of people who were hoping that you would fail or just at least assuming that something like this wouldn't get off the ground. So congratulations that you're going in. Here it is in March of 2024. You're ready to go. You've got your first class, and you guys are going to be successful this fall. That's fantastic.
Thanks.
So, Jacob Hallin, thank you so much. He's the Provost and Dean of Intellectual Foundations at the University of Austin, right here just down the road. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been a great pleasure, Ryan. Thank you, Derek.
And for all of our listeners, for all of our watchers, we appreciate you listening as always. And as we like to say in the words of Sam Houston, do good and risk the consequences. We'll see you next time.